Thought is the husbandman which brings to ripeness the seed of adeptship in man. Thought also the instrument employed. The mind is both a source of limitation and the means of release. A second paradox. For the mind of man is the seat of his egohood, and therefore, as agent of separateness, must symbolically die. In another aspect, the mind is the seat of that power by which unity is first recognized and later realized. Therefore, the mind, as agent for union with the whole, must live and grow and come to full fruition. The mind is also the instrument by which the pressure to hastened fulfillment is applied. The early morning of each day is therefore devoted to the use and culture of the mind. Withdrawn in privacy, the body in complete repose, the spine erect, the attention is focused first upon the higher self within the abstract aspect of the mind. At first, that higher self is visualized in form acceptable to the temperament of the seer. It may truthfully be conceived as light, focused in an area extended far beyond the physical body. At its heart is the light source, shining with an intenser glow at this center. Consciousness exists there, and the whole radiant sphere is endowed with intellect. Is intellect, in essence, manifest as light of many hues. Attention is continually directed into this sphere, which is the vehicle of the divine consciousness in man, so that gradually and by persistent effort, the center of human awareness becomes transferred from the brain into the higher self. The barriers between them consist of the physical tissue of the brain and skull, and the etheric, emotional, and mental substances of which those several principles of man are built. These barriers are penetrated by daily effort to elevate the consciousness through, beyond, and above the brain, feeling, and thought into awareness within the higher immortal self. A way exists along which consciousness can thus move. It is the bridge down which consciousness passed on its incarnating path during prenatal life. This path partly closes after birth, as does completely the anterior fontanelle, which is its physical entrance from below. By daily meditation upon the higher self, to the end of self-realization therein, that path may be reopened, and the opening power is thought. Therefore, day by day, and preferably several times a day, the power of thought is applied to this channel, that it may be opened by sheer force of thought and will. At the same time, from above, the inner self, source of the impulse to attempt the quest, directs its power and light through mind and emotion into the brain. Thus, from below and from above, the two centers of human awareness, the physical and the higher mental, gradually approach each other, drawn together by aspiring thought and awakened will to self-illumination and self-mastery. Affirmations made in power assist the mind and the will to maintain the concentrated thought and the determined pressure essential to achievement. Examples of such affirmations are: I am divine, immortal, eternal. I affirm and realize my divinity, my immortality, and my eternity. Divine is the self. I am the divine self. That self am I. Immortal is the self. I am the immortal self. That self am I. Eternal is the self. I am the eternal self. That self am I. The self in me is one with the self in all. I am that self in all. That self am I. Such phrases as these, mentally affirmed with increasing depth and fullness of realization, serve to exalt the consciousness. Oft repeated, continually affirmed, with concentrated thought and will, they will most surely take man across the bridge of the immortals, which is no outer bridge, but shines within himself. Beyond the reincarnating higher self, deep within the center and the source of light is that from which center and source proceed. It is the spark of the one flame, the true center of individuality and existence in man, the monadic self. The monad is to the higher self what that self is to the physical, mortal man. The aspirant must therefore pass onwards, beyond and above the reincarnating principle of egohood, to the root identity of man, which is indeed a point of fire, a spark of deific flame. To reach this highest, deepest self, the veritable self of the microcosmic man, intenser effort must be employed. With the higher self partially realized, and realization deepening with daily practice, consciousness essays or tries a far greater flight, a far more momentous transference. To this end, the whole being must be offered up in ardent sacrifice, to become a surrendered vehicle of the monadic self. Day by day, and even hour by hour, the monad is deliberately invoked into the higher self, and through that into the life of the mortal man. Fire is now the image used, as was light in the stage before. The monad is a being of fire. It is a concentration of the divine will into one spark-like embodiment. The monad is an incarnation of the omnipotent will of spirit, of the fire from which the universe was built, within which it was conceived, and by which it is sustained. The realm of occult fire, the region of spiritual flame, is now entered as monadic self-awareness is achieved. Deific powers are then tapped. Will force, in a fiery, irresistible stream, pours down into and through the higher self, to reach and mightily empower the mortal man on earth. Thus, metaphorically in a chariot of fire, the monad descends in consciousness from highest heaven to earth. Thus thereafter, man ascends in that same chariot of fire, Elijah-like, to the highest state of spiritual consciousness. The personal and the egoic selves are reabsorbed into that monadic center of divine fire and intelligence from which they long ago emerged. As the ascent is achieved, exploration of the regions entered is carried out, deepening realization of state after state of exalted and expanded consciousness is attained by the daily practice of self-illumination, self-exaltation, and self-empowerment. Wholly to succeed, practice in thought must be accompanied meticulously by practice in deed. The way of life must increasingly and continuously express both the ardent aspiration of the inner man and the fruits of the success attained. Practice in action must accompany practice in thought. If this be not so, man becomes guilty of the great occult sin of hypocrisy. Steadily, therefore, and despite many falls, the daily, hourly life of the aspirant becomes more spiritual, more idealistic, more considerate, and more humane. This continues until a veritable transformation has occurred, a process which culminates in the transfiguration of the mortal man into the full likeness of the immortal shining self, the self of light. Eventually, that light self, in its turn, is transformed into the likeness of the self of fire, and then it is that man becomes Superman. Chapter 5. Discipleship. The life experiences of every human being constitute an apprenticeship in the workshop of nature. Each effort, every achievement, each failure, every defeat, all happiness and all pain play their essential parts in training the apprentice for his or her appointed role. That role is foreordained and foreknown by the master craftsmen who have every human ego in their charge. The future role is the guiding principle in all the training which the master trainer gives. Preparation for that foreseen role is the task to which every ego is turned and is guided, and for which every ego is trained. Large numbers of unawakened egos are in the charge of their teachers, as sheep are in charge of their shepherds. Every member of the group is known individually, is watched, guarded, and tended with consummate skill and compassionate concern. Certain adept officials in the inner government of the world assume this task of the guardianship of groups of human beings. In the hierarchy of the adepts, each adept head of one of the seven rays, or human temperaments, receives responsibility for a numbered group of souls. The whole human race upon the globe, every monad ego on the planet, is in the direct charge and care of the supreme head of the adept hierarchy on earth, the Lord of the world. Under him, according to rank, his adept assistants undertake the direction of groups of decreasing numbers according to their capacity. No one is ever outside this compassionate care and love. No one is, for a moment, outside the consciousness of the adepts, and even the most recalcitrant and rebellious person is held safe within that care. No wickedness or waywardness of personalities, no prideful egoism of exalted minds causes any withdrawal of guidance or any cessation of the continuous shepherding care of which all men are the recipients. Whole nations of millions of egos are in the charge of adept officiants appointed to these nations. Groups within nations, karmically united from past and even future lives, have their attendant watchers. Individuals are not lost in this vast shepherding of millions by one adept. His consciousness is deliberately extended to include them all. His life flows into and through them all. His will vivifies and spiritually stimulates them all. Centuries are as naught in this great process of egoic ministration. Life follows life for each individual, but no one is lost sight of for a moment. The choices of sex, caste, color, and environment that are made at each reincarnation are the product of careful consultations with adept and archangelic authorities. The karmic lords also have their own representatives on earth, on each continent, and within each nation. Karma, or the result of the operation of the law of cause and effect, is carefully weighed before and also after each new birth. The best that can be provided is invariably and infallibly arranged. Adversities are mitigated as far as may be. Every beneficial act is made the most of and used to soften suffering inseparable from maleficence. When deep suffering is inevitable, special watch is kept to see that no overweight is placed upon the individual, and that the strain and the pain do not exceed karma's just decree, and the ego's power educatively to endure. When, as a result of this guidance and experience, and of nature's gradually applied pressure, an ego is seen at last to be spiritually awakening, then that ego's future mission enters increasingly into the adept's calculations. Past, present, and future become a unity, a totality of karma and dharma, or duty, or right fulfillment of life, are to be taken into account. Training becomes more individual and more precise thereafter. The ego concerned, to a greater extent admitted to consultation, makes choices and increasingly cooperates in their ratification or fulfillment. Filled more and more with the will to attain, conscious of growing pressure from within, the awakened ego demands a rapid settling of karmic debts. Reckless at times of the danger to the personality, which as a result becomes the crucible of a fiery transmutation. Then the adept guides and warns. Then the karmic lords make choice. To the highest ends and by the wisest means, they direct the selection of nation and parentage and the degree of adversity which shall be endured. The ego is followed down, as it were, into rebirth, and special guardianship is maintained. When, after many lives and much success, strength and stability have been developed, idealism adopted, and appetites subdued, the adept teacher of that soul appears to him. At first, unknown and unseen, the master-to-be inspires and directs his inner life and molds somewhat his outer circumstances, all to the ends of spiritual progress, opportunity to serve, and closer contact with himself. Then, at last, the aspirant enters on that life in which the way of holiness will be definitely found and deliberately trodden. His master watches him, appears to him in dreams, stimulates his egoic and personal development, awakens nascent faculties, and draws him into contact with his seniors on the upward way, who can lead him to discipleship. As far as the ego is concerned, discipleship itself is always a conscious experience. Whilst the body sleeps, the ego, fully awakened and self-knowing, meets the master face to face, generally at his abode. The question is then put by the master to the aspirant, whether he desires to enter upon the path under that adept's direction and to be trained by him. Full clarity of vision is ensured to the individual on that momentous occasion. Full freedom of decision is allowed to him. The opportunities, the necessities, the ordeals and the trials are all fully explained. He is free to refuse, to ask for delay, or to embrace at once the tremendous opportunity. Discipleship constitutes for man entry upon a phase of unfoldment analogous to the formation of the bud in a plant. For both man and plant, promise of a new and revolutionary form of self-manifestation then arises. For man, the way of life entered upon is the way of selflessness, self-giving, and self-surrender, which will culminate in the full flower of a perfect life. The perfection of man, his efflorescence, implies both full self-development and the full release in power, beauty, and spiritual fragrance of all that has been attained. Discipleship of an adept is the rarest privilege and greatest opportunity to which pre-initiate man can attain. For then a human being becomes intimately associated with a superhuman being, a man with a superman. The occult path of hastened evolution out of humanity into superhumanity is entered upon. A bridge between the two stages and kingdoms has been constructed by an adept for an individual human being. The disciple is established by his master upon that bridge, is shown how to march across, is strengthened, directed, and attracted to the other side. The vision of the master and the knowledge that he has been found and that he supremely cares for the disciple and watches over him in themselves constitute tremendous incentives. Nevermore is the disciple alone, never outside a great and paternal love. His soul is cherished by his master. He knows that fact and is empowered and exalted by his knowledge. The master's own attainment is a sign to him that he too can similarly attain. The master's power and wisdom evoke his highest reverence and love. The master's gracious friendliness encourages and inspires him. Signs are granted that the master watches over the disciple. Visions by day and by night demonstrate the master's love and watchful care. Agentship and channelship, the occasional rush of power and healing force, all prove physically to the disciple the reality of the superphysical and spiritual relationship. A benediction rests upon him, and with increasing frequency, that blessing is bestowed on those in his environment. His power of comprehension deepens, his intellectual capacities increase. He studies with new fruitfulness, both brain and mind, displaying unexpected faculties. Thus the disciple grows most rapidly in the sunshine of the master's power, love, and constant use of him to help the world. The disciple's outer life is not without sorrow, strain, and intensest effort. However full of light, the life within, bodily discipline, selfless motivation in all things, and a deep and true humility, despite the sense of growing power and privilege, must now characterize his life. Subtle barriers and temptations confront and assail him, all arising from a long-established and habitual selfishness. The old Adam does not die easily and quickly. Humiliations and defeats mark his new life, especially at its beginning. Will is then the factor that brings him through and keeps him pressing on. At his first fully conscious conference with the adept teacher, and later at his acceptance as disciple by his master, the will to full attainment is awakened and brought down into the personality. The monadic fire now mingles with the egoic light. Under the master's directing power, both play down into the mind, and ultimately, as burning will to mastery, reach the waking consciousness. This fiery inner will arouses and empowers the disciple without surcease, never ending. He learns to draw upon his own spiritual power, to rest upon its might, and by its aid to burn out and extirpate the undesirable attributes which betray him and bring him to shame. This is the function of the adept master on his disciple's behalf, to help to bridge the gap between the monad and the man upon earth, to bring down the fire of monadic will into the brain, so that the almost superhuman task of swift self-perfecting be not impossible of fulfillment to one who is still but man. By virtue of the awakened inner will, the disciple continues unyieldingly to ascend, faces the long, steep, and often darkened way which leads upwards to heights beyond his view. By will, the temptations which assail him are eventually resisted and self-indulgence overcome. The powers and beings of darkness do not fail to note his growing power and to place obstacles in his way. With piercing insight, they perceive his weaknesses and deliberately intensify them, even as the master intensifies all his highest powers. Subtle snares are set for him. Sensual allurements tempt him. Ultimately, he must pierce and pass through them all. Though seeming enemies, the beings of darkness and their enticements prove useful in his development. They bring out his weaknesses and force their recognition upon him, as also the necessity for their replacement by their opposite powers. Falls, though bringing shame and sorrow to the neophyte, are never finally decisive. They are always educative, and in due course, the monadic will elevates and re-inspires him to press on to full self-mastery. His master, too, does not fail to encourage and instruct him in the meaning of both defeat and victory. Thus, largely in secrecy, sometimes in seclusion, the inward way is found and trodden. Thus, that inner life is lived, which takes a man out of the human into the superhuman kingdom of nature. Chapter 6. Seven Types of Disciples. Entry upon the path of discipleship marks the germination of the seed of adeptship inherent in man. The master's task is both arduous and onerous, adept though he be, for he has to work upon materials, the substance and attributes of the disciples' vehicles, as yet largely unprepared, untested, and unproven. The real character and inward nature of the disciple are as yet but partially developed and but instinctually expressed. The waywardness and the indeterminacy of man may at any time spiritually impoverish the disciple, may undo, if not ruin, the master's work. The dominating idea of absolute self-mastery is not yet fully awake in the disciple. The irrevocable will to attain the highest possible development in the shortest possible time is not yet aroused and active in him. Improvement and awakening occur all too slowly in some cases. The first fiery impulse resulting from direct contact with a superman can die away. Illusion can darken and deceive the disciple's mind, and sophists may persuade him of his folly and charge him with insanity. All these tests both draw out the disciple's inward power and display to him unmistakably his weaknesses. His reactions to such experiences are not readily calculable, even by an adept who is an expert in assessing human character and in occult education. At any time, the unpredictability of man may upset all his, the master's, calculations and ruin all his work. Nevertheless, with consummate skill, the master aids the neophyte, assists directly and visibly at certain times, personally advises and instructs at others, and yet again decides to minister in absentia, so that the disciple must needs rely upon himself alone. The temperaments of disciples vary greatly according to their ray. First ray men, the men of will, are headstrong, often uncontrollable, exceptionally self-willed, impulsive, and they tend to extremes. Heedlessness besets them when once an objective is in view. Their heavens crash in consequence, brought down in ruin by their own hands, and they are plunged into despair, from which they rise only by the powerful action of the awakening will. They must become men of power, lords of will, with strategy and wisdom added to fiery will. Second-ray disciples, the men of wisdom and universal love, can too easily lose heart, especially when crushed by the disasters inseparable from the path. Will to achieve and the master's tenderness restore their faith and set them studying the causes of the experience and the ways of prevention and cure. Thus for them, ever deeper wisdom is born. The heart opens again in its glowing golden petals, and love shines through once more as roseate light. Purity, stainlessness, and steadfastness must be developed by those who one day will be lords of wisdom and love. The third ray aspirants, the men of intellect, can be cold and calculating, knowing not at first the fire of love and zeal which keep the reformer's feet upon the upward way. The habit of the quid pro quo is not easily lost, nor self-interest renounced. Strategy and tactics become ends in themselves, with the tempting prize of prestige as the reward. Their master must be skilled to turn these valued powers to right purposes and to evoke the desired selflessness. Such mind-ruled men can become both cold and argumentative, zealous and restive under the master's hand. Their very pride of mental accuracy and reasoning power is a pit into which all too often they fall. Light, rather than burning zeal or fiery will, redeems them. The light of their higher reasoning than that which they have hitherto employed. Longer vision and more extended views reveal to them the errors of mind myopia, however logically founded, and so they advance along their path, becoming men of penetrating vision and lords of light. Fourth-ray disciples, lovers of beauty, suffer much from vagueness of purpose, loss of enthusiasm, and sudden volte-face, and the lapse into inconsequence. Beauty reawakens them as nothing else, but the attributes of other rays, also awakening in them, must be employed to elevate them spiritually and to maintain them on the heights. The fire of genius more easily reaches them than some other types of men. The egoic light shines down, inspiring and arousing them into spurts and periods of intense and skilled activity. A great call to artistic effort, an opportunity to undertake a major work of art, an inward pressure to perfect and express their innate genius, or all three combined, serve to raise them to the heights and make them malleable under the master's hands. Such disciples will one day become men of genius in the arts and lords of beauty. Fifth ray man, using the formal, ratiocinating mind, employs method, rule, and precision in his quest. So sure must he be that each forward step is soundly based and correctly directed that he may lose valuable time and become too much involved in the details of the occult life. He is sometimes a plodder, and when awakened, rarely either delights his master with brilliant success or saddens him with a deplorable defeat. The qualities of other rays are needed to enfire the coldly reasoning mind from which all activity tends to spring. Nevertheless, as higher mind blends increasingly with lower, and the pursuit of abstract truth is added to the search for concrete facts, fifth ray disciples are amongst their master's most useful and most trustworthy instruments of action in the outer world. Used constantly by him to this end, examining and classifying each experience, they become specialists and experts in occult science. The mysticism, which is more particularly of the mind, reveals to them the wider truths and the deeper facts of macrocosm and microcosm, and they experience increasingly the interior unity of the noumena of the greater and the lesser worlds. They become men of knowledge and lords of intellectual and spiritual light, sharing eventually in the attainments of their brothers of the third ray. Sixth ray disciples, devotees and enthusiasts, are generally of two distinct types: the contemplative, mystic, devotee and quietist, and the reformer, burning with ardor, brimming over with zeal, forever yearning to be active in some chosen cause. Each must receive appropriate aid, each be directed to a wider vision and a more selfless zeal. The mystic suffers from morbidity, the reformer from ill-directed action. The qualities of other rays must be awakened and employed by both before their diverse methods may bring them to their goal. The sixth ray disciple, who balances his natural characteristics with those of the third and fifth rays, becomes a genius of spiritual insight and of active service for the fulfillment of great plans. He needs steadfastness to offset the changefulness characteristic of emotion, however exalted, which is the mainspring of his active pursuance of the path. Fanatical intolerance and narrowness of vision and purpose dog the footsteps and delay the progress of such aspirants. Until they break free of the past, tradition can bind and fetter them. They must conquer ingrained habits, control passionate ardor, and in utter self-surrender, lay themselves at their master's feet and learn to act thereafter on their master's rather than on their own command. They then become great saints with passion sublimated and lords of the yoga of surrender and self-sacrifice. Seventh ray disciples, men of power in ordered activity, suffer from worldliness. Deep-rooted in their souls is the tendency to express in full magnificence of outer form and even pomp and circumstance that splendor which they conceive to be the highest attribute of the deity. Occultly awakened by evolutionary progress, directed by their master and inspired by him, they perceive increasingly the relative places of spiritual kingliness and earthly royalty. Drawn irresistibly to splendor, magnificence, and fullness without limit, perceiving these as attributes of the God in nature and in man, they seek the princely, knightly life and tread the royal way. Karma inevitably trains by limiting them, as they enter upon a path which may only be trodden by souls steeped in deep humility. Accentuate the life, even whilst using the form. Perfect and beautify the form as vehicle for the life. Simplify the form, thus perfected and subordinated to the exigencies of the life to be made manifest. Thus fate and their masters counsel them. Obedient, they seek the inner life of nature and the secret powers of man. Men of the second and sixth rays are spiritual brothers, as also are those of the first and seventh, and the third and fifth rays, like those of the fourth ray. Seventh ray occultists seek the accurate and beautiful expression through mind and body of that regal power which they perceive in the deity and know increasingly to be their own highest attribute. Penetrating deeply the occult mysteries, magic becomes their instrument. Occult ceremonial, sacred rites, intercommunion between devas and men, the generation, evocation, and distribution of spiritual power to the end of victory by light over darkness, by life over form, these concern them as they advance to become kingly men and lords of beauty and of power. These several types of men and blends of types advance from the human ranks and present themselves to the adept hierarchy seeking and demanding light. None may be refused. By iron law, guidance must be accorded to each of them in their search for that to which they aspire. Masters amongst the adepts are apportioned to them, and for each the great trial begins, to end either in glorious and lasting victory or humiliating but only temporary defeat. The divine within mankind is undefeatable, even whilst its human embodiment goes down constantly to defeat. This the master knows, and therefore never lightly lets the pupil go, however recalcitrant he or she may become. Final failure is impossible. Ultimate success is assured. Only the time required to attain is at stake, and to shorten that time, masters take as pupils those sufficiently advanced to desire that privileged to the end of more efficient service and more successful living. The fact is important to mankind that no one who is ready is ever overlooked. No one who egoically applies is ever refused. The Adept Brotherhood serves humanity with flawless precision and perfect wisdom. Chapter 7. The Master is Found. Opportunity is nature's indication that the human soul approaches perfection. Opportunity knocks at the door of the house in which the outer man is dwelling to bring the message that the self within him is about to flower. Opportunity takes many forms, though in all it is a messenger from the world without to the man within. Opportunity is the one sure sign of readiness for the great quest. Until the doors open wide of themselves, full success upon that quest will be delayed. Closed doors are the sign that work within remains as yet undone, that debts remain unpaid, that needed strength is as yet undeveloped, and that the wisdom thus far gained is insufficient for the pilgrim's need. Therefore, let those who seek the Master's feet, yet find the pathway closed, carefully examine every phase of character. Keeping the idea of the Master clearly before them, let them employ themselves in self-development, in preparation for the quest. When the time is ripe, doors will open, and one will stand within who says, "Come thou with me." He is the guide sent specially to lead the soul along the unaccustomed way. He is the friend predestined from the past to point the way. Then comes the way itself, at first perhaps smooth, present, edged with fragrant flowers, and easy for the pilgrim's feet. Far ahead it may be seen, leading onwards to distant peaks through wasteland and wilderness, where flowers give way to desert sand, the smooth path to rocks and thorns, and wild winds in icy gusts bear down upon the traveller, chilling his very heart. These may seem cruel, but the soul is tempered by them, the spirit tried, and the strong will tested. Friends fail, promised substance is withheld, crowds jeer, enemies assail, misfortune dogs the pilgrim on the steepening way. The joy of the newly opened door, the counsel of the ever-present friend, the Master, the flowered ease and happiness of first discovery, all these give place to arduous toil, steep ascent, and growing loneliness. Then must he who would proceed prove stout of heart. Then the value is shown of the waiting years, when strength and character were being developed. He needs them now to keep him wise and steadfast on the way. Again the voice is heard. Persevere, O pilgrim. Pass your tests. Let nothing daunt you now. For coming down the mountainside is the one you seek, the Master who has watched you from afar. Seeing now your victories, acquainted with the fiber of your soul, he comes to gladden you and aid you on the cruel, razor-edged path. He knows well that path, having trodden it to its very end. He is your teacher, foreordained, your predestined guide to the supernal heights, bound to you and to his task by kinship of the spirit and by obedience to the order to which he belongs, the brotherhood of those who light the way. Press onwards towards him, even if as yet you see him not. Fix fast your gaze ahead of you. Walk warily and carefully, but keep on, for he draws nigh. At last the great event occurs, for which the open doors have proved a sign. The Master, who has long awaited the pilgrim soul, has come to meet him on the upward way. The disciple-to-be beholds him face to face, tall, strong, wise, compassionate. Within his eyes, he sees full knowledge of every pain that he has endured and every tear that he has shed. The Master knows, and that is the discovery which gives peace. Everything the aspirant has ever been and done, and all his joys and hopes and fears and falls are known. Despite the falls, the Master comes to welcome him, and the full knowledge shining in his eyes brings perfect peace, evokes the utmost trust. Happy is that disciple to be who perceives his Master's knowledge of himself and trusts him from the very first. Unhappy are those who, having journeyed thus far, find doubt, both tempter and destroyer of their peace. Abandonment of the upward way exists potentially for them. Knowing this, the Master's strong, sure hand clasps that of the lonely wanderer. The voice, earlier heard in dreams, now speaks. Vibrant in his ear, music to his heart, the Master's voice welcomes and encourages him. This meeting between teacher and neophyte was foreordained and marks an epoch in his life as aspirant. It is the fulfillment of a desire, long cherished, of a hope, long held, to meet the Master face to face, to know, and to be known by him. The experience comes to all who ardently aspire and who will prepare and wisely plan their quest, founding their hopes on inward strength, on stable character, and on incomparable and inexhaustible love for all their fellow men and every living thing. For thus the Master loves, and like draws like to the predestined meeting place. Together now, both look back upon the road behind. The Master shows the meaning, the message, and the cause of each experience, and understanding of the mysterious laws of life deepens. They look forward, the Master pointing out the stages of the way, the tests and the difficulties, and how they may be overcome. They also look inwards into the disciple's soul, appraising powers and weaknesses, and planning the progress which must be made.